Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are really have a pleasure tonight. In our studio is someone who's done groundbreaking work in our country, groundbreaking work here at Morgan State University. He's Melvin Mitchell. Melvin Mitchell is an architect. His book is The Crisis of the African-American Architect, Conflicting Cultures of Architecture and Black Power. And from 1997 to 2002, he was the director and dean of the School of Architecture and Planning here at Morgan State University and founded the intensely important and growing undergraduate program in architecture. Here for the 10th anniversary, are that right? And he's going to give a speech here tonight at 6:30 at the Murphy Fine Arts Building here on campus. And so he's here first for dashing over to a speech, which you're free to go to and just keep us in your head on iPod or something. And Melvin Mitchell, welcome. Good to have
you. Thank you. Thank you. Real pleasure and honor to be here.
It's great to have you here. So I was really, as looking at your book, there's so many things I didn't think about until I started reading your book. One was also the dearth of African-American architects in America. I think of 1.5% of all architects are African-American.
Well, that's today. If you turn the clock back a few years, 50 years, that would be maybe 0.02%. And then, of course, if you keep turning the clock back, you have to understand architecture is, to be quite candid, because it still is to some extent, it's a white gentleman's profession. So there should be nothing shocking about the fact that that the numbers are so low.
But you make the point, which I thought was really fascinating, that in the great 20th century revolution of African-American intellectual and artistic thought and power, the Harlem Renaissance,
right,
that architects played no part in it at all.
Well,
or little part.
To the extent that we've been able to document very, very little, it had to do with a cultural schism, so to speak. Architecture was still, as the revolution was going on, far as the intellectuals, the writers, the painters, the poets, architects, unlike, say, in Europe, when you had all of the arts, including the architects, coming together. First of all, there were very few architects during that time. You're talking about the 1920s to 30s. But to the extent that there were a handful of them, they were more inclined to buy into the notion of architecture as pretty much purely a technical operation as opposed to having cultural implications. I mean, they understood there were cultural implications, but those were pretty much assumed and accepted as white cultural implications,
right,
by default or otherwise. So the notion when you're talking about a black cultural revolution and the notion of architecture and the conflating of the word architecture and black, that was pretty much a no-no and a killer for his the few architects that there was there. You know, that was seen as obscene. You know, they were really going outside the lines. And so
no pun intended.
Right. And so I like to say that in our first big revolution, our first big party, we were missing. The architects were missing, and all sorts of reasons, but we were missing.
But there were some great early African American architects.
There were indeed. Now that's the other part of sort of the conflict, because architects, really black architects, their origins as modern black architects, their origin was insofar as the Northern cultural revolutionaries, they had the wrong place for their origin. Their origin was Tuskegee, Alabama, and Booker T. Washington. He saw and understood the need for architects to help him build his black city, in contradistinction to, say, the Chicago World's Fair in 1889 as the white city. Tuskegee was our black city. And Mr. Washington was adamant in that there were going to be black architects running and managing that operation. That was quite a feat because he had a lot of money, a lot of white philanthropic money coming in, and all of those money guys and gals would always say, yeah, I'm going to give you all this money. I want you to build a building. And, my architect in New York, Mr. Washington, somehow managed to, we got some people that'll build the buildings.
And those people, those men and that were in that world,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they also went on beyond Tuskegee. I mean,
that was the launching pad. It all started with a man named Robert Taylor,
right,
who was the first black architect to graduate from America's first architecture school, MIT. You know, he was the son of North Carolina builder and a teacher. Parents, and they managed to get him to MIT, and he got through and was the valedictorian in his class, and somehow
and that was what year?
That would have also been in 1881,
right,
92.
Right.
And somehow, Mr. Washington, who had this amazing machine and talent for recruiting and spotting out talent, wound up there. Somehow, in Boston, whispering in this guy's ear, I've got something for you to do with your life. And Robert Taylor said, okay.
I mean, that.
And that was the beginning of it.
Those parts, you see, this is where I think that our history is so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as understanding what happened at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the idea that a black man graduated from MIT.
Right, right.
In 1891 or 92.
That's right.
As an architect.
The very first in the country. Now, subsequent, after that there were others, but that is the first one because again, MIT was the first architecture school and it took them 25 years after their initial founding in the 1860s. To decide that, hey, let's do this. It was Boston, so.
Right, right.
But so he did that, and he went back with Mr. Washington to take charge of moving the campus to the next level, so to speak. Washington had built the campus up to that point, originally founded in 1881. He'd built the campus, started from a chicken farm, and he built it essentially using students and lay people and carpenters, all black. They built their bricks. They did a whole lot of interesting things. But it was an idea that took off and started to grow big and serious. And so Washington knew that he was going to, in order to move it to the next level and fulfill its ultimate potential, he was going to need serious professional help. So he started off with Robert Taylor. Taylor, in turn, with his help, brought in some others, Rayford Logan, Pittman, Sidney Pittman. And then these men eventually would go off into other places and build.
Across the country.
Across the country.
That's one place.
Not directly, but in an interesting way. The L.A. connection has to do with the fact that there was this probably 13, 14-year-old paper boy in L.A. during the 1900s, early 90s, as Tuskegee was developing black architects. He was in high school, and he had this notion of being an architect, black paper boy. And of course, he had people telling him, "That's preposterous. Your people. You want to be an architect? So, he was selling newspapers, and there was something I don't know if you've ever heard of called the Pittsburgh Courier, the national black press.
Right.
And he got a hold of one, and he found this picture and this story about a black architect having designed something in Virginia, somewhere in the South, called the Negro Building. So that was proof. That was all that young Paul R. Williams needed. That's who it was, Paul Williams, who would go on to become, the most you know, the most renowned, the most famous black architect. But Paul Williams was
Paul Williams was one who was the architect to the stars?
Paul Williams.
Is that right?
Paul Williams benefited from the fact that he was in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles was a place in which, you know, I mean, it wasn't the Deep South. It had, I mean, there were issues, but there's just nowhere. So, and you got to think about, you know, the Los Angeles, the stars, Hollywood. Those people tended to be progressive to liberal in outlook, and so Paul Williams had the benefit of several white mentors who saw the talent and, you know, decided to help him. You know, mentors who knew how to build big, rich, big houses for important people. So that led to Williams getting an opportunity to.
And he literally did. He was the one who built many of the houses of some of the most famous early stars in Hollywood.
He did, in fact. And those people all, you know, they saw that as a badge of honor to be able to say, "Here's my architect," you know, and that wasn't all. Peaches and cream, you know. He had clients, not the stars, of course, but he had clients who basically didn't know that they had called or were about to engage a black architect, and when they saw him, they backed away. And one of the little tricks he learned to do was to put them at ease, was to learn how to draw upside down. He said, "Okay, you don't have to come huddle with me. You know, you can stay there." And he'd draw the. So it was some interesting stuff, really interesting
so
stuff.
So when you make some kind of very powerful, broad arguments about discussions about the role of culture,
yes,
in architecture.
Right. Here again, architecture is, you know, there's two parts to it. You know, it's technical, it's math, and it's science, but it's also culture. But that culture was by default considered white. Now, in Europe, you know, the modernist architects in Europe were about a cultural mission as well, you know, to go along with the technical. And they, of course, pioneered modern architecture and brought that to the States. Of course, Frank Lloyd Wright would dispute that. You know, he felt he was doing some things earlier, rightly so. But nonetheless, the cultural issue is a big one here because, look, black culture, African-American culture, along with Jewish culture, those have been the driving engines of American culture in all aspects of art and, you know, artistic things, the performing arts, the plastic arts. So how then could you exclude architecture from that?
How could you?
But it somehow got separated, you know. And so that's why in by the 20s, when we were having the big revolution in Harlem, even a man like Paul Williams dared not link his work to blackness. You just didn't conflate the two. I mean, it's ridiculous now in hindsight, looking back on that, but that was the reality.
I think the issue you raise about how the foundations of a lot of especially popular and American culture mm-hmm. comes out of African-American and Jewish roots is correct. I mean, that's...
Yes. Right.
And some people don't want to address that a lot.
Right. But right. Well, I did, you know.
You did in your book and you do now. But so what does it mean for an African-American architect in the 21st century?
Well, good question, good point. Up until probably maybe 20 years ago, 10 had begun to intensify, this notion of black architects, because by that time, you know, say 20 years ago, you know, I mean, by that time the numbers had grown. There probably were, you know, maybe 800, 900, 1,000 in the country out of, say, you know, 100, 120,000. They've doubled now. But they still basically bought into the notion that architecture was not so much about culture as it was strictly a technical endeavor, and that it just was a line that didn't need to be crossed. And they felt that they had to do that. Now, it's interesting that they did feel that, because really practically all of their clientele was white. was black. Williams was the exception out there in the West Coast with a white clientele.
Chevron Chaney, Desi Arnaz, Zsa Gabor,
absolutely,
all these people.
Absolutely, right.
But the black
architects coming out of Tuskegee and spreading to other places around the country, as far, Chicago and even points further west, their clientele was essentially the black community, the churches, the small businesses. That was their clientele. I mean, there was always an exception, but their clientele was essentially the black community. Now, the black community back then was maybe itself conflicted about the notion of, well, do we want to get into, trying to conflate the issues of architecture and blackness. So, really, today's young architect. Black architects, they have been embracing their cultural roots and have been bringing that dimension into architecture to the point now today where I think I'd say almost totally acceptable that architecture has cultural dimensions and cultural dynamics, and that the point is that today we can all say American architecture is as black as it is white, as it is yellow. That's the reality.
I neglected to say that we're live here. 410-319-8888 is the number. Many of you maybe have graduated from Oregon's architecture program and graduate school or undergraduate. Want to join us? We are here if you don't have to have done that, anybody can join us at 410-319-8888. Melvin Mitchell, who was director and dean of the School of Architecture and Planning here at Morgan from 1997 to 2002, and also founded the undergraduate program. That's a hugely important component. He's here for the 10th anniversary of that to speak tonight at 6:30 here at the Murphy Fine Arts Auditorium on campus. And he is the author of the book, The Crisis of the African-American Architect, Conflicting Cultures of Architecture and Black Power, 410-319-8888. Calls come in. We'll get to you in just a second. As soon as I see who you are on the screen. So how does that manifest itself, in terms of the work itself?
Physically, dynamically, you have to go back. the people who took black culture most seriously were the French. I mean, they really took it seriously. So around the turn of the century, an artist who you may not know, and I expect you will, named Picasso.
Yeah, I think I've heard of Picasso.
He stumbles onto some stuff in Paris,
right,
in a musty museum, the Trocadero Museum, and it was African art, West African art, sculpture, paintings, mainly sculpture and masks. Blew the guy's mind, just blew his mind. That was the next phase, the next revolutionary phase in American art, the change over from representational to, abstract and modern.
A European's interpretation of what Africans did.
Absolutely, right, absolutely.
Right, right.
It got the name of Cubism, really. So to the extent that you look at American architecture, art and architecture, you have to make a comparison or to think about it in terms of music. Now, we know that there's such a thing as black music. We understand and we accept that. It's America's soundtrack.
Right.
Okay, well, the architecture, because see, when I talk about black architecture, I'm not talking today about it being the exclusive domain of or practiced by black people. Lots of white architects, starting with the great Le Corbusier, were the ultimate, purveyors and perpetrators of a black architecture in the sense of its African roots and connections, and also in the sense of one of the main things, driving things about modern architecture, the whole notion of it being dynamic and having movement, but music if we take music as our model, and we look at music, there's all sorts of connections and relationships and similarities, but I'm just really glad to be able today to be in a world in which these things are now accepted and given. Nobody has to, slink around or hold their head about it.
Let me get a phone call in here too, and this is also thanks to the work you've done here at Morgan State University. It's helped advance that, I think, at 410-319-8888. Melvin Mitchell is with us. His book is The Crisis of the African-American Architect, Conflicting Cultures of Architecture and Black Power, speaking here at 6:30 at Morgan State University's campus on the 10th anniversary of the undergraduate architecture program he founded here at Morgan State. And Catherine, you're on the air.
Good evening,
good evening,
Mr.
Catherine.
Mitchell. I wanted to reach out to you and let you know that my organization, Sisters Saving the City, has a vision to build an out-of-school time youth village in the Park Heights community. And the graduating seniors from Morgan School of Architecture and Planning will be doing a presentation of the concept designs for that out-of-school time village. And they've been working with us for this is our second year now that we've worked with them. So they're bringing it to the community. So we will be at the Delta Center on December 5th. And I think this is the first time this has ever happened when, the students have actually come and displayed their designs to the community. And the young people also, we have students coming from Northwestern High School to see their work. So we're real excited about it. And I just wanted to let you know that your vision is continuing on and it's moved into the community.
That's wonderful to hear. And if I can learn more about it, on the December 5th, if I'm in town, that is to say, in the general greater Washington, Baltimore area, I'd love to be able to come by and participate.
So we're excited. Professor Bridges has just been very gracious.
Oh, Leon, dear old friend.
And reaching out, who was the first licensed black architect in the state of Maryland? So, yeah, we're really proud and we're really glad, and I hope you'll come. And, Mr. Steiner, I've been trying to get on your show for about a year now.
It's like you made it.
I guess you made it, and we'll have to get the information. We'll make sure that we talk.
Okay. All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And since Catherine called, one of the things I thought about was the women in architecture. I mean,
making strides.
Beverly Green to the young June Grant of today.
Okay,
there's a world there.
Making strides. There's some brilliant African American women designers, and a number of them on their own firms, on their own businesses. Some of them are high up in the corporate world. So that's definitely a long way to go, but. It's not like it was yesterday.
Yeah. So when you wrote a piece on Harlem,
yes,
which was interesting,
mm-hmm.
Just about that in some ways challenging the idea, but also talking about the idea that Harlem was lost.
Oh, that was in another magazine.
It was another magazine. It was also on your
website. Yeah. Well, The notion there has been batted about as to, is Harlem lost or who lost it and all of those kind of things. I mean, I was really just dealing with the fact that, or the reality that Harlem is undergoing a serious gentrification, but I spent a lot of time there. I tried to, and to the extent that I can see, it's still the cultural capital of Black America, simply because New York continues to be the cultural capital of America. So there are some issues there. You think about real estate and real estate prices, the adjacency. That's where the deals and the bargains are. And let's face it, young white people have never had problems understanding a good deal and a good bargain. That's why the Morgan program, why we've been able to be so successful there. People understand quality. So I think for the foreseeable future, I think it will continue to be a black mecca. But nonetheless, it is definitely changing.
Now, whose work as architects coming up African-American architects kind of explore the depth of the African-American experience
without a doubt. We had a tremendous battle we waged a few years back. I like to think I was right in the center of it in my capacity with the National Organization of Minority Architects. The Commission of the Century, a half billion dollar museum, the African American Museum of History and Culture down on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Now, in times past, that would have automatically gone to, been limited to A-list white architects. But because of a lot of work, a lot of ground by a lot of people, the list of architects to be looked at was expanded to include the best black talent in the country in a competitive, open way. And they prevailed. So there's an architecture team that is going to design, or that is designing that museum, because they've already been selected. One of the members is the architect for the new school at Morgan, Phil Freelon. Another is David Ajayi, a very interesting case. He's a Tanzanian Ghanaian, London-based, and I think, you know, he probably had a lot to do with the concept that they came up with, and then of course part of their team was the late Max Bond, who was a New York architect, right, who was the dean of black architects, and he was able to see them, I think, selected before he finally succumbed. But there's stuff going on all over. But there's no question that this notion of incorporating all of our roots, black architects, white architects, whoever, the palette is full now. People can look at things that they would never have looked at, and can acknowledge things that nobody would have ever, you know.
Well, Melvin, I want to say this has been just a treat and an honor to meet you. That preparing for this program, I learned so much that I never even realized about our art, architecture, and our history that you've allowed me to open my eyes to.
All right.
And I appreciate the work you've done and your coming to our studios this evening.
Thank you.
And let me encourage you all, the man who is dean of this school here from 97 to 2002, founded the undergraduate program in architecture here at Morgan State University as well. The book is The Crisis of African-American Architect, Conflicting Cultures of Architecture and Black Power. We'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 here in the Murphy Fine Arts Building at Morgan State's campus. So if you're not doing anything, you should go over or even change your plans and go over and hear what he has to say and join the wonderful graduates of the undergraduate and graduate departments here with him. And Melvin Mitchell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And folks, we'll be right back. We're going to talk about another exhibit actually at Morgan State University now, which is on black male identity art. We have David Brown, Schroeder Cherry, and Colette VC Colors with us, three of the artists, talking about their work and black male identity. So stay with us for that. We'll be back in about a minute.